Good evening, and welcome to this evening's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Dr. Meredith Rudolph. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. David Agus, best-selling author of The End of Illness. Dr. Agus is one of the world's leading biomedical researchers and cancer physicians. He heads the University of Southern California's Westside Cancer Center and the Center for Applied Molecular Medicine. He is also a professor of medicine and engineering at the USC Keck School of Medicine and the Viterbi School of Engineering. Dr. Agus chairs the Global Agenda Council on Genetics for World Economic Program and is co-founder of Applied Proteomics and Navigenics, two healthcare technology and wellness companies. He received his undergraduate degree from Princeton University and his medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. After completing his residency at Johns Hopkins Hospital, Dr. Agus became an oncology fellow at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, where he headed the Laboratory of Tumor Biology and spent 2 years at the National Institute of Health as a Howard Hughes Medical Institute Research Scholar. He has also served as director of the Lewis Warshaw Prostate Cancer Center and director of the Spielberg Family Center for Applied Proteomics at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Dr. Agus has received numerous professional honors and awards, including the American Cancer Society Physician Research Award, and in 2009, he was named a rock star of science by GQ Magazine. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. David Agus.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I'm going to take you on a little bit of a journey tonight. I'm going to tell you about the premise for the new book we have out called The End of Illness. And The End of Illness is an aggressive title. The end of illness is something I truly believe. I believe that we can all live until our 9th or 10th decade by preventing disease. I'm going to tell you how I approach that and give you some framework for where I come about. But so the first question is, why is a cancer doctor talking about general health? Why is a cancer doctor talking about prevention? And it really comes from the old adage that if you wish for peace, understand war. And so I've been at the edge of the cliff for the last 2.5 decades fighting cancer. And everything we learned from that, or I've learned from that, I've brought back for general health, as I'll show you, in a very different way of approaching health and healthcare. So tonight we'll talk about proposing a new model for health. We'll talk about how one can individually apply that. And then in general, we'll talk about how technology will fit in. I'm a true believer that technology is what's going to allow us to go to that next step with regard to health, disease, and prevention. So first, what is health? If I asked you now, how would you define health? Are you healthy? Is it your cholesterol? Is it your weight? Is it how you feel? Is it how you sleep? Is it how you look? What is health? We don't have a marker for health. And any engineer will tell you, if you want to optimize a system, you need something on which to optimize upon. And so for the first is, we need to figure out ways to design and develop a metric for health. And so we'll talk some about that tonight. But it really is an important question. When you go to your physician, what are you optimizing on? What does health truly mean? So Mark Twain said, the only way to keep your health is to eat what you don't want, drink what you don't like, and do what you'd rather not. It's obviously not exactly a picture of something we're all fond of. You know, originally when I submitted this book to the publisher, I called it What is Health? And a question mark. And I got a call from the publisher saying, Steve Jobs called and actually changed the title of your book. And I was like, really? And I called Steve and I said, well, why did you call the publisher and not me? He goes, David, it's their job, not yours, to do the marketing for the book. And so he said, when you use the word health in a title, it's akin to chewing cardboard. And so, and I get it, is that whenever we talk about health, either people's eyes glaze over or they look differently and askew at you. But truly, we need to think about health differently. We need to be optimistic about it. Take it head on and look at it in a very different perspective than historically we have. And so again, when you go to that metric, in our country, in 2009, so 2 years ago, we spent over $1 billion on growth hormone. And these are in people who were not short stature. Why? Because if I gave it to you as a 50, 60, 70-year-old, within a couple of months, you would look buff. You'd look muscular. You'd feel good. Everybody would say, what did you do? You look amazing. And it does. It will change you so you look better. The problem is that you'll live a decade or less or more less than if you didn't get it. So again, it's what's your metric. Do you care about what you look like today or do you care about the long term? And I think it's a very important analogy when we start to look at these things, as we'll talk about. So we know, for example, that if you look at animals, whether they be yeast or flies or mice, the smaller animal, the ones with the least muscle mass, live longer. And we know there's a group in Ecuador where they have a mutation in the growth hormone signaling pathway. They actually get no diabetes and no cancer. So we know this pathway, when it's poorly active or not active enough, people actually do better. Yet we're out there taking drugs to stimulate it the other direction. So something's a little bit goofy there. So obviously our goal is to live until our 90s. The dirty secret is that evolution selects out for who has good kids. It doesn't select out for who lives until their 90s or 100. And so when evolution is selecting out for progeny, we need to optimize to get to our 9th or 10th decade. And that's one of the messages we're going to talk about tonight, is that, again, we haven't evolved to live longer. We've evolved to have better children. And so if we want to start to change that, we actually need to do a little bit of work. So the key is avoiding disease. I'm a cancer doctor. 2 or 3 times a week, I have to look someone in the eye and say, listen, I've run out of drugs to treat you. I no longer can treat your disease, and the disease is going to win. And I don't want to do that anymore. So the only way I know to do that is to actually prevent disease. And I truly believe we can do it for most diseases. And that prevention doesn't need to be started at age 5. I believe it can be started at age 60 or 70 and still have an impact. The paradox is you reduce disease till your 80s, 90s, or 100, you're going to lower healthcare costs dramatically. If you look at the data, when people past the age of 80, when they get sick, they don't go in an intensive care unit. They don't go on a ventilator as much. We actually reduce costs. And I think when we look forward, you know, in 1956 was the last year in the United States where you could die with a diagnosis on a death certificate of old age. Ever since then, we've had to pick a cause for death. They died of lung cancer. They died of this, of that. I want to go back to dying of old age. And I believe we can with the technology and the therapies that we have. Medicine was screwed in the 1920s by infectious disease. When you made a diagnosis with infectious disease, you knew the treatment, right? That bacteria didn't care if you were short, fat, tall, round, skinny, green, yellow, blue. As soon as you made the diagnosis, you knew the treatment. Haldane, who was a remarkable thinker in the 20s and 30s, you know, made the statement that it's a disaster for medicine because we're going to get focused on these germs and we're going to forget about the system. And he was right. When you start to treat diseases like Alzheimer's, like diabetes, like cancer, like heart disease, like infectious disease, you screw up, right? Because that cares who the host is. We are a complex emergent system. And when you try to make it reductionist and try to look at one aspect, make the diagnosis and have the treatment, it doesn't work anymore. And so that's one of the messages is you don't have to understand a complex emergent system to control it, as I'll show you. And so if you look at diseases over the last 60 years, so this is from 1950 to 2007 at the death rates. If you're diagnosed with heart disease, almost a 70% decline in the death rate. Stroke, 77%. Infections, you know, 66%. Cancer, 8%. So obviously we did better in these than these. Why are these dramatic decreases in the first two? Two reasons. Smoking less in this country. Second reason is statins, right? So statin is a class of drugs that were originally developed to lower LDL. They were developed to lower the bad cholesterol. Turns out a byproduct of statins is they block inflammation, as we'll talk about. The biggest drug in history, we got the mechanism wrong. yet its effect was real and lasting. It's one of the only classes of drug, if not the only class of drug, that actually makes you live longer by all the data we have now, which is close to 40 years of follow-up of patients on this drug, and we'll talk about it. But this notion of disease in the body is a complex system, again, it's a little bit, people eyes glaze over when you say that. But look at it this way. You've got inputs. Input is your diet. Input is your genetics. Input is what you do during the day. It's your environment. It's your spouse. Those are all the inputs. The output is how you feel. Well, historically, that middle state function has been hidden. We now have the technology, for the first time, of actually looking at it, as I'll show you, the first pictures of that middle state function. But the amazing thing is that if you look at these complex emergent systems, it is almost impossible to understand. Yet you can control them. If you ask my 11-year-old, how do you stop a train? The first thing he will say is you pull the brake. He doesn't say what's the speed of the train, what's the temperature of the track, what are the wheels made of. He doesn't try to understand everything. He realizes that with enough force in one direction, it's going to work. And so a complex emergent system can be controlled without understood. So for the last 50 years in fields like cancer, we've been trying to understand every aspect. And it's way too complex for us to understand. We went back, and I'm one guilty as any others. I was one of the heads of the Cancer Genome Project. We sequenced the cancer genome. But remember, it's not just the cancer cell, it's the interaction of the cancer with the body. And we forgot that. And so that's one of the fundamental things I think we got wrong over the last several decades. So again, I think we can understand some aspects of disease, but we don't need to understand all of them to control them. And that's key. You know, an amazing clinical trial was done about 10 years ago where they took women diagnosed with breast cancer and they gave them optimal treatment. And then after treatment, they randomized the group. Half got placebo. It was ethical because they got the regular treatment. And then half got a drug that builds bone for osteoporosis. The recurrence of the cancer was down by 40% when they got a drug for osteoporosis. And you say, why would that be? Because breast cancer metastasizes to bone. And you change the soil, the seed doesn't grow as well. So one of the greatest survival advantages we've seen in a trial of breast cancer and a drug that didn't even touch the breast cancer. 1997, I was a trainee at Sloan Kettering, and a kid came in with germ cell tumor in the brain, the lung, and the liver. And they told him, listen, chemotherapy is going to make you sick. Why don't you go on to Texas and spend your last 3 or 4 months with your family, because that's what really counts. Well, this kid, he went to Indianapolis, and he got platinum, the same thing in my wedding band. He got it because some goofball doc, and I say goofball in a positive sense, took 2 platinum electrodes in a gel and said, do cancer cells like electricity or don't they? And the platinum, they didn't care about the electricity of the cancer cells. The platinum killed a couple of the cells, so they gave it intravenously to this kid. And he was part of a clinical trial and got this intravenous medicine. Well, a year and a half later, he won his first of 7 Tours de France. So Lance Armstrong received platinum, and obviously it dramatically changed him. I don't know why platinum works. You know, Lance and I had dinner last Tuesday, and I still couldn't tell him why this drug that allowed him to go back and be one of the world's greatest athletes, be a hero for all cancer patients, I don't know why it worked. There's no data that it actually touches a cancer cell. For some reason, platinum changed his system so the cancer didn't want to grow anymore. And so our field all the time does this hand-waving. I know the mechanism of this. Most of the drugs we have, we don't know the mechanism. Yet, at the same time, we can have a dramatic impact on disease if we start to look at the data. And so I am the same field that said, do no harm, right? And I'm the same field that said, listen, you know, Camels are better than other cigarettes. They hurt the throat less. I'm the same field that said, not one thing of throat irritation. Luckies are less irritating. You go through these. This is me. This is our field. Even more egregious is 25, 30 years ago, we said, have margarine, not butter. And we killed a couple million people by doing that. So we're very good at making recommendations. We're not as good at looking at the data behind them and saying, does it really make sense to do that? So I'm going to give you a couple of examples here of things that we do that, again, I got to look at the underlying data. So the current notion, if you ask my patients, what do you do for exercise? They all say, I go to the gym for an hour, or I have a trainer for an hour. I put a tape on for an hour of aerobic exercise, and then I sit at my desk the rest of the day. Well, if you start to look at the data, Sitting at your desk the rest of the day negates that hour at the gym. Great to be that hour, but you can't sit the rest of the day. And the initial study done on this was wild. It was 1953, and it was a guy named Jeremiah Morris, a scientist, published this paper in the journal Lancet, one of the great British medical journals, and nobody looked at it for a couple of decades. What he did was he looked at the British Transit Authority workers, and there were two classes of them. There were over 20,000 of them. The first class was the people who drove the buses. They called them conductors. They sat 90% of the day. And the other class, same weight between the two classes, by the way, the other class were what were called the ticket takers, who walked around the buses and took the tickets from the people on the bus. And if they looked about it, the death from heart disease was dramatically lower in the ticket takers compared to the bus drivers. Why? Because they moved. Turns out your lymphatics, which will control your immune system and put order in your body, there's no muscle in their walls. So it's the rhythmic contraction of the muscles in your legs when you walk that actually allow the lymph to circulate, that actually allow your body to function. And yet we sit at the desk all day. You know, look at this, is this from the same paper. And it's wild. They looked at profession and risk of death. And professions like hairdressers, where you stood in one place, typists, where they just sat and typed, versus gardeners or coal miners, where they moved. Dramatic difference. Believe it or not, the coal miners were much healthier than the secretaries because they moved during the day. So I got one of those little accelerometers. This is one that's actually being launched tomorrow by Nike. You wear it on your hand, and it tells you what you're doing during the day, how much you move. And I realized I was sitting more than I thought, almost half the day. So I got one of those phones that made me look like an air traffic controller. And now when I talk on the phone, I walk around my office and I reduce by 60% the amount of time I sit down. Had a dramatic effect on health if you start to look at the data. So obviously we're not doing everything wrong, right? Worldwide life expectancy is getting longer. This is around the world. One of the big reasons we keep living longer is we're getting rid of child mortality. So if you think about it as a statistician, you get rid of child mortality, you're going to get a lot of years on the back end if you get rid of kids who die at age 1, 2, 3, or even infants, right? It doesn't mean each of us, if we live past the age of 5, are living longer, although we're starting to see that. But the problem around the rest of the world now is they're catching up with us in what we call the non-communicable diseases. I was at the World Economic Forum in Davos this year, and the health minister, Zaire, came up to me and said, you know, 2.5-fold more people in my country die of cancer than HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. And all I get from the United States is malaria pills. I need help here. Remember, half of those people in sub-Saharan Africa are dying from cervical cancer, which we have a vaccine for, yet it's a frozen vaccine. And you can't administer a frozen vaccine in sub-Saharan Africa. So obviously, a slightly different topic than today. But when we look here, this is the U.S. mortality. And you start to look, heart disease, preventable. Cancer, preventable. Stroke, preventable. Almost all of these are delayable and preventable. And we'll talk about some of the data. And obviously, we can make an impact here. One of the big impacts is technology. 1974, Monsanto, in their annual report, said $150 million to sequence one gene. We all saw the New York Times 2 weeks ago where the $1,000 genome will happen this year. I did a Nightline 3 weeks ago where Bill Weir, the Nightline anchor, came into my office. And in real time, while he was there, we sequenced his DNA. And we showed that he had a risk factor for heart disease live on TV. Based on this, we put him through a heart scan. And live on TV, we showed that this 42-year-old, who was thin, who exercised, had a big lesion in the artery going into his heart called the LAD. And, you know, the amazing to me is that, first of all, the next day, the American Heart Association wrote a letter saying, "Egg is screwed up. This guy wasn't eligible for screening." So the first question was, then your screening criteria screwed up because he was positive. And they said, well, screening we shouldn't really talk about because there are a lot of false positives and we shouldn't be doing as much of it. And again, then we should be arguing that we need better technology. We need more resources to develop technology for screening, because unless we start to identify what we're each up against, how are we going to prevent disease? And so, in all disclosure, I am a founder of a company here in Silicon Valley called Navigenics. Navigenics is a company where you spit into a tube, we sequence your DNA, and in a period of about a week or 10 days later, you get this. Where you log in and talk to a genetic counselor, I'm a firm believer that I want genetic counselors involved. And this is me, on a piece of paper. This is my DNA, and I can look at my average lifetime risk for a number of diseases. And so all of a sudden, I know where to focus. All of a sudden, I know what to do in my healthcare, where I need to put emphasis. And I can say, listen, in the United States last year, 4,100 people died of colon cancer under the age of 50. Yet we only screened for colon cancer at age 50. What do you say to those people? Well, the risk-reward curves didn't come together. You weren't eligible. No, we say you're a higher likelihood genetically of colon cancer, so let's screen you early. So I had screening at age 40. They found a polyp. Would it have become cancer? I don't know, but I'm not willing to take that risk. And again, to me, it was almost religious seeing this on paper. I changed my behavior. I ate better. My kids got it. They started to talk to me every time, Dad, do you really need to order French fries? And they got it because I had a 35, 40% risk of heart disease. And it made a difference in my life. And so even if it just changes behavior, that's a major impact. But you look at that Bill Weir story, the Nightline anchor, and obviously made a big difference. You know, we test for diseases like Alzheimer's. And we could tell you your lifetime risk of Alzheimer's. And there are people who come back over 80% chance. And I don't know if any of you read the papers over the last 2 weeks, but Alzheimer's will be a disease of the past over the next decade. It is absolutely amazing. There are two fundamental discoveries that happen that are transformative. The first is they developed a mouse model where they took a couple of cells that made the abnormal protein in Alzheimer's and they put it in the mouse. And then they looked a couple of weeks later and those proteins had spread throughout the brain of the mouse and the mouse had all the symptoms of Alzheimer's. So the notion that it's a brain problem is wrong. It's a problem of a couple of cells and those proteins travel throughout the brain. And the next is they actually took a drug for lymphoma that's FDA approved and on the market, and they gave it to mice with Alzheimer's. When a mouse, you put a napkin in a cage, they start chewing up the napkin and they make a little nest. When a mouse has Alzheimer's, they sit in the corner and they do nothing. They had the mice with Alzheimer's. They gave them this drug. 2 days later, they started making nests with the paper. They looked in the brain after 48 hours, 60% of those abnormal proteins were gone. So again, if we can start to identify disease and what you're likely to get and put you on treatments that we'll talk about that can prevent things and delay them, the magic pills will be there. And I firmly believe that we're going to start to reverse more diseases as we go forward. We just need to delay. And so obviously all of us want to blame our parents for everything. It's easy. But what this chart shows is you start to look, the black is the genetics, and the white is environment. So almost every disease has an environmental component and a genetic component. We can control our environment. We're in charge of it. So even if you have a high risk genetically, we can start to work in our environment or even with medicines to reverse it. And that's the key here going forward is identify what you're up against and then start to manipulate it the other direction. So looking at preventive strategies, aspirin, right? Aspirin has been around since the ages. Aspirin, an entire year of baby aspirin, and this is what the data is on, 81 milligrams of baby aspirin a day. An entire year of baby aspirin costs $3.50. If you take it for 5 years, the death due to GI cancers is down 54%. 20 years, death due to prostate cancer down 10%. 20 years, death due to lung cancer down 30%. 20 years, colorectal cancer down 40%. 20 years, death to esophageal cancer down 60%. Cardiovascular disease, an 8-year delay in cardiovascular disease by taking an aspirin a day. So again, when you look at healthcare in the United States as 16.5% of gross domestic product and growing literally year by year, and we say, listen, you have a heart attack and you're on Medicare over 65, our country will pay for anything that happens to you. Shouldn't we say first you need to go on preventive strategies? How are we going to affect health unless we start to push on prevention? We're the number one spender in the world, yet we're ranked 32nd in health. That's not a healthcare finance problem. That's a healthcare problem. And the key to that is prevention. We talked before about statins. They were developed to inhibit the production of LDL, the bad cholesterol. One of their dominant mechanisms was found in something called the Jupiter study, where they took people with a normal cholesterol, a low cholesterol, and an elevated inflammation, and they randomized them to placebo or one of the statins. There was almost a decade delay in heart disease and stroke in those people with a normal cholesterol.
there was a 30% reduction overall in cancer in several studies looking at statins. Statins, are they expensive? You know, when I came out with this in the book and talked about this at one of the TED conferences, all these people went online and said, Agus is a shill for the drug company. He's pushing pharmaceuticals. This is a generic that if one went without health insurance to Walmart, it is $9 for a 90-day supply. So yes, I'm pushing a drug, but I'm pushing a drug because I care and I don't want disease to happen. And this is a drug that has been shown in 4 randomized studies with over 20,000 people to make people live longer before they have disease. And so if we want to really affect health in this country, we have to push on ideas like prevention. So the other aspect that really is crazy in our country is the concept of vitamins. So look at this study. 39,000 women tracked over 19 years. They looked at women who took multivitamins, vitamin B6, folic acid, magnesium, zinc, copper, and iron. And it turns out the women who took the vitamins actually were lower body mass index, were healthier at baseline, lower diabetes, and lower blood pressure because they cared about their health and they thought they were taking these vitamins. And when you start to look at the data, there was a 15% higher death rate. Death is a bad side effect. A death rate in people who took the vitamins. Not a benefit, a death rate. Then you start to look at some of the other studies. You know, these are headlines that I pulled from the internet and newspapers over the last 6 months with vitamin D. According to these headlines, it will do everything. It will cure every disease known to mankind and change our entire life population. If you look at the data, 97% of African Americans and 75% of overall Caucasians in the country are low in vitamin D. So first of all, who defined what normal is? I didn't come with an instruction manual when I was born. Many of you may have, but I didn't. I don't know what normal is. So if we really do have this epidemic of low vitamin D in our country over the last decade, why is hip fracture rate going down, not up? Doesn't make sense to me. The only reason you and I tan is to block vitamin D absorption. So our body, evolutionary, has a very complex mechanism that takes a lot of energy to block too much vitamin D, yet we take it in a pill all the time. So if you think about it, there's vitamin D, there's the receptor, and there's 6 signaling molecules, yet we're only measuring one node of a network. So if you're low in vitamin D, you probably are just high in the receptor or high in one of the signaling molecules. We only measure one because we can. 2 years ago in Canada, they made it illegal to measure vitamin D. Why? Because it was 11% of the country's healthcare budget was spent measuring vitamin D. Yet there has yet to be a study showing a benefit to vitamin D supplementation. In fact, if you take women over the age of 70 and give them high-dose vitamin D to raise their levels, which it does, there's a 26% increase in bone fractures, not decrease, increase. You look at that and you say, well, that doesn't really make sense. Then you look at the study where they took women in the nurse's health study and gave them calcium and vitamin D at a much lower dose. No effect on bone fracture at all. And these were younger women to older women. And so again, you take a high dose of vitamin D, you downregulate receptor, you screw up signaling. The body's very good at those homeostatic things. So never a benefit, yet we do it. The reason we do it is there are association studies. People with lower vitamin D have a higher risk of heart disease, cancer. And so we say, listen, if that's the case, let's just give them more vitamin D. People who smoke have lower vitamin D. People who are obese have lower vitamin D. You can't tell me if I give you vitamin D, you're going to stop smoking. Yet there are those associations. And my field jumps all the time to these associations, yet we don't look at the data. No benefit in that regard. One even more troublesome study came out this year. It was actually in the New York Times yesterday. Almost 35,000 men study where they took a vitamin E every day. And this is the same dose that's in a multivitamin. And what they found is that if you took it for 3 years, your rate of prostate cancer was 17% higher. And it lasted for 3 or 4 years after stopping the vitamin E. The most common non-skin cancer in men, 17% elevated. Can you imagine the tens of billions of dollars a year that costs society? Yet there's never been a positive study in the history of mankind with vitamin E. And yet we all do it. If you start to look at the data, close to 45% of men over the age of 60 take vitamin E. So again, what am I missing here? I'm not getting it. So the government was very clever, and they looked at 63 randomized studies with more than 500 people with multivitamins. In none of them did they show a benefit with heart disease and cancer. These are the only 63 studies that were powered to show a benefit. None of them did. In 2004, a study came out looking at beta-carotene and vitamin A versus placebo in 18,000 smokers and former smokers. 28% higher lung cancer rate and 17% higher death in the people who took the supplements. So again, an entire industry with tens of billions of dollars a year spent and is costing our taxpayer dollars in Medicare tens of billion dollars a year. So again, we need to start to look at the data to make a difference. So I'm not trying to be all negative here. I want to be positive also. 1976, if one thought one was pregnant as a woman, you would take a tube of blood, you would go to a hospital, because it could only be done in a hospital. We would take your blood and we would inject it into a rabbit. 5 days later, we would sacrifice that poor rabbit. And if the rabbit's ovaries were enlarged, you were pregnant. That was the state of the art in 1976. 1977, Warner Chilcutt came out for $10 for the pregnancy test. So the whole field of reproduction medicine transformed by one proteomic test. That's a protein-based test. Obviously, the rabbits of the world rejoiced. But at the same time, we had a binary outcome, a black-white answer that gave us what was going on with pregnancy, and it was transformative. I want these same technologies applied to all diseases. I just told you I don't like vitamins. I just told you I like statins and aspirin. But again, I feel guilty saying those generalizations. I want to personalize things. I want people to have a test and to say, yes, you will benefit from an aspirin or you won't, because obviously not everybody benefits. I want people to say, yes, you may benefit from vitamin E. You clearly won't, and it'll increase your risk of cancer. And all of a sudden, we're starting to develop technologies that will do that over the next several years. And this is one of them. It's actually the cover of the book. And so this is a drop of blood going through a superconducting magnet where we get a 60 gigabyte image or picture of all the proteins in the blood. And so it's that middle state function we showed you before. This is it. This is a picture of a person one moment in time. And we can start to collect this data and actually start to make correlations to disease. We all get colonoscopy. We should at age 50. Yet only 16% of the population does who should. What if we had a blood test for colonic polyps? Right? If we didn't have PSA tests in men, every man at age 50 would get a prostate biopsy, which would be crazy. But we've got a test where we look for a delta, a change, and then we do a biopsy. It's the same thing here. If we could start to develop these for every individualized treatment, we could actually start to have true personalized medicine, and that's where it's going. So everybody then says to me, what's next? Well, it turns out, no offense to you people, is that each of you have tenfold more bacteria in your body than you do cells in the body. And so if someone in China, if I look at their incidence of prostate cancer or breast cancer, it's one-tenth of what ours is. After they move to the United States, after a decade, it starts to approach ours. And we always say, it's the McDonald's, it's the Burger King. Well, it turns out that's not the case. It turns out as they adopt our bacteria, our microbiome, it's called. And these bacteria, well, they control how you metabolize your food. They control your hormone levels. And they adopt it from our water and our environment, and they start to adopt our level of risk for disease after a decade. And so for the first time this year, we've been able to quantify this microbiome, these bacteria. Over the next several years, we're going to start to change them. We're going to start to modulate them based on your individual risk. And so I've got a sense of optimism for what's happening, ranging from those Alzheimer's studies to technology like this will make a big difference. But I want to end on one of the simplest things in the book that I think has the most profound effect on health, and that is regularity and schedule. So it turns out, if you have your lunch today at noon and tomorrow at 2 o'clock, for 2 hours, stress hormones go up as you wait to eat your food. When stress hormones go up, your body starts to go in conservation mode. It saves energy because it's saying, listen, a lion may come, and I got to save energy to flee that lion. And when it does that, you get about a 30% decline in cognition. Your exercise performance goes down about 36%, and you lower your metabolism, so you actually gain weight. So one of the easiest ways to be healthy is be regular in your schedule. Get up the same time, go to bed the same time, eat the same time. I don't care if you have 2 meals a day or 6. It's the regularity that's key. It's the person who grabs an apple randomly during the day that hurts themselves. Grab an apple every day at 3 o'clock, greatest thing in the world. So the key is the regularity part. Your body loves to know what to expect. In fact, if you look at CEOs functional till they're 90, the one thing in common is regularity in schedule, and the data are profound. And so we'd love to answer questions and talk more about any aspects. You know, the book came out in mid-January, and we're proud to say that it's been number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 4 weeks in a row, which for a book like this is surprising. The Chinese government announced that four aspects of the book they're going to start to put into law, and they're going to start to mandate, because, again, healthcare in China is 3.8% of GDP. If it gets to 5%, they're in trouble, and they want to prevent that, so they're going to focus on prevention. I certainly wish in our country we could do the same. So thank you. The answer is 17 milligrams twice a day.
Twice a day. And in fact, one of those first questions was, and what supplements and vitamins do you take?
I take none. I mean, again, there is no randomized data showing a benefit. And again, the caveats are, if you're pregnant, you should be taking those prenatal vitamins. There's certainly eye conditions in the eye where certain vitamins can help. If you're a vegetarian or you have a very abnormal diet, you may need some. But other than that, I don't see a benefit. And again, in the book, there are several chapters going through all the data, the good and the bad, and I haven't seen a study that shows a benefit yet.
Well, thank you, Dr. Agus. My name's Karen Story. I'm a co-founder of the wellness community that was started here in Mountain View. There are several in Southern California.
Yeah, it's great.
So I'm very pleased to hear about the work that you've been doing in regards to cancer and so forth. When I was listening to your bio, I was wondering if you could talk a minute. How did you get to California? It sounded like all your background was on the East Coast.
I was a Sloan Kettering doc. I had trained at Hopkins, and Andy Grove came to me one day, and we had been working in the field of lymphoma, and Andy said, you know, Agus, I like what you're doing, it's interesting, but on the East Coast, you're going to hit singles. You come to the West Coast, you can actually swing for the fences. You strike out, you start again, but you got to take risk. And our field has been so shy of taking risk. And so Andy really pushed me to come west. We did it, and we haven't looked back. I mean, it's an honor to be in California. I mean, California is different than any other place I've been, especially in this country. It will really push things and question things and look for new ways, whether it be applying technology or thinking about health.
And that sort of struck me as an interesting question, and it's like, you obviously have patients that you take care of. You've started two companies, and in your free time, you decided to write a book?
You know, I look every day, you know, and I look at someone in the eye and say, I have no more drugs to treat you. And, you know, I've been honored to work with some remarkable people and develop new ways of approaching health as this complex system. And I wanted to scale it. I wanted to get out there and push aggressively. And again, you know, I get, since the book came out, I probably got 20,000 negative emails. You know, I take away a crutch if I tell you vitamins don't work. Many of you in the audience and people across the country, that's their crutch they've been leaning on for decades. And I'm pulling it out from under them. And so you get hate emails. You get negative comments. You get all kinds of people threatening you. At the same point, I have no choice. I really believe, and I need to push, so we can try to do healthcare better in this country.
I've got so many questions here, so you're going to have to, we'll go
I'm ready.
As quick as we can go. And they're not going to be in any particular order here. During an annual physical exam, what are the most important questions one should ask their doctor?
Great question. So one of the things in the book, or even if you don't buy the book, you can go online to theendofillness.com and download a 4-page questionnaire. I want you to look at yourself. Look at the hair on your legs, which with circulation problems can go away. I want you to look at the changes in your body. I want you to check your blood pressure. You know, you go to your doctor at 1 o'clock and they check your blood pressure and say, hey, it's high, you need a pill. Whoever check your blood pressure when you get up in the morning? Who checked it when you go to bed at night? Who checked it when you're pissed off after a phone call? I want enough data. There's an old adage, enough data, error goes away. I want you to go in there with all that information so you're 5, 10, if you're lucky, 15 minutes with your doc, you can actually use it to your advantage.
Actually, in reading the book, I noticed the whole list of questions, and mm-hmm. I think it would make for one for self-diagnosis and also to pay attention to one's own health. So it was a great list.
You know your body best. I mean, thank you. I mean, I when people come in knowing everything and knowing their changes, they get the best care.
Right. Okay, this one, there's a couple of them that are in regards to the actual genome tests and so forth.
Yes.
One says, do you believe that a $1,000 test will be widely available through current healthcare providers? And along that line, should it be covered by insurance companies? And, well, let's start with those two.
So the average time on a health plan in the United States presently is about 4 years. So these are businesses, and they say, listen, you know, Agus, you're 47 years old. Your heart attack isn't on average going to happen until you're 58. So why should I push for prevention? You're going to be on somebody else's plan. So we need to change that culture here. Doctors get incentivized to do procedures and do tests. They don't get incentivized to prevent. If I prevent disease, all of a sudden, I'm not doing the things that can actually generate income to pay for my nurse's salary, my salary, et cetera. We need to restructure healthcare to do this right. Technology, whether it be genomics, which is the most mature, followed by proteomics, microbiomics, et cetera, is clearly a way we could do things more efficiently and better. Right now, health insurers need to be shown that it's cost-effective before they'll bring it on. There needs to be a return on investment. So it took 22 years to show that mammograms save lives. You all saw the debate over the last year about PSA testing in men. It's one of the most crazy things I've ever seen. In that countries that screen with PSA have half the death rate from prostate cancer of countries that don't. There was a study done in New England Journal of Medicine that caused this furor where they had 6,000 people, they said, get tested every year, and 6,000 people, they said, do whatever you want, and after 6 years, they looked at survival. No difference. Well, 73% of patients who do whatever you want got tested every year. So the reason the study didn't work, it was a non-statistical, poorly planned, stupid study. It didn't say that PSA testing didn't work. Clearly, the argument should be, should everybody with cancer be treated? And the answer is no. I have 1,100 patients in our clinic that are being followed with prostate cancer because they don't need to be treatment at the current time. We re-biopsy them at certain given intervals, but we know what they have isn't going to cause a problem. So there's an art to medicine, and that's what we have to start to promote and understand, and not these crazy rules by the government's quality assessment. Well, we shouldn't be doing any testing at all. So DNA testing is available now for $300, $400. You can get it today, pay out of pocket. With Navigenics, the company I founded, probably 95% of the business is companies doing it for their employees, including insurance plan doing it for their employees and their customers. Because they realize if they prevent one case of colon cancer, it's $248,000 to their bottom line. So there are obviously other reasons they're doing it, which is to make, you know, save them money in the long run, but it benefits all of us in the short run.
So along those lines, one of the questions that I had, and yeah. You showed the report and the reports in the book, and you talked about the newscaster. Can an individual, without a doctor, take advantage of having the DNA testing?
With the company that I co-founded, the answer is no, you need to do it with your doctor. And I'm a firm believer that I want healthcare to be a partnership with you, your doctor, and in this case, the genetic counselor at the company. But there are companies you could do it without a doctor. But again, I really believe I want that partnership to happen. I want you and your doctor to discuss things. The reason I wrote the book is so you can go in there with all the information, whether it be aspirin, statins, and not say, I want a statin. Say, why shouldn't I be on one? And have that discussion. Everyone thinks decisions in medicine are black and white. They're shades of gray. And it's your value system and the data that you make the right decision for you with your physician. There's no right answer. The right answers.
In fact, one of the questions that was along the same lines was, do you think that eventually that this could replace the need for long-term care insurance?
No, because, you know, think about it. If you're in front of two Chinese restaurants and you look at the ingredient list, they're exactly the same. You then taste the food. One could be fantastic and one could be horrible. Well, genetics is your ingredient list. It says, you know, what the ingredients going in are. It doesn't say what's happening that moment in time. Other technologies, proteomics, may be what it tastes like. And other technologies will come in. So it's going to be a multitude of technologies that will eventually start to change healthcare. There's not one technology that will win.
Are any of the major health plans working on integrating this with their health insurance?
Yeah, one of the largest, a company called Highmark, which is the largest Blue Cross out of Pennsylvania, has integrated this with their health plan. And they launched it about a year ago. It's a tremendous success. And, you know, they're an aggressive plan, and they're developing. The problem with the Blue Cross is they can't cross state borders. So they're taking their plan now, and they're trying to implement it in two other states, Florida and I think Ohio, and it will hopefully be expanded to others.
And how, anyone in California?
Right now, no, although Kaiser is looking at doing things. But, yeah, in terms of health plans, our health plans in California aren't as aggressive. Companies are. Certainly Cisco, Intel, Microsoft are implementing it in California, and it's been tremendously successful.
Okay. a little different question. Can you discuss how your philosophy and or approach is different from integrative or holistic medicine?
I think it's integrated or holistic medicine with technology, my approach. And so, again, my partners in what I do, I mean, I think it's important to mention. So one is a guy named Murray Gell-Mann. Murray is probably the greatest living physicist. He discovered the quark and string theory. He won the Nobel Prize in 1969. And so he's now working with me on cancer. And a guy named Danny Hillis, who built the first supercomputer and discovered RAID storage. So an engineer, a physicist, and a biologist working together on an approach, and I hopefully can take this holistic view of medicine to a view of science and put the two together and make it the next generation.
Okay. Are you familiar with macrobiotics? And please share your thoughts.
You know, I think whenever you start to brand things, whether it be macrobiotic or I eat the paleo diet or this diet, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, to me, it's not just what you eat, but it's where it's from. So when you go to any fruit and vegetable, they were designed by somebody upstairs, and when they're picked, they start to degrade almost immediately. So you need to go into the supermarket and say, what came in fresh today? So if you go and get an organic vegetable that's been there for 3 days, it has zero nutritional value. Either got what came in fresh that day or get what's flash frozen. So in today's world, sometimes it's hard to get things or you want something out of season. Flash frozen is a lot healthier than something that's been there for days. So I don't think you can say a particular kind of diet is right. I think it's, you know, you need to know your food. Obviously, if you get something that's locally grown at a farmer's market, there's nothing better. But short of that, flash frozen makes a lot of sense.
In researching and reading reviews about your book, it seems that statins was one, if not the most controversial topics. Is this a relatively new drug concept, and why so controversial?
You know, it surprised me. I mean, the statins is literally, you know, a small component to the book. But this notion of promoting something involving pharmaceutical companies is considered bad in this country. And again, I have no ties to a pharmaceutical company. I have, you know, no financial motive here at all. This is 40 years of data we have now, and it's the only class of drug where it actually makes people live longer. And in people without disease, if you started in your 20s, there's data that is more beneficial than starting in your 30s or 40s. And so inflammation seems to be the root of heart disease and cancer, and statins are a very effective means of blocking inflammation. And get a load of this. I mean, if you skip your flu shot this year, most of you would survive, 99% of you. And you'd do fine. You'd have 5-6 days of having the flu. But a decade from now, your rate of heart disease and cancer would be up 10 and 12% respectively because of the inflammation associated with that influenza infection. So I want people to care about not just today, but also tomorrow. And statins are a way we can really optimize on tomorrow. And again, like anybody else, I hope there are things that are better than statins. I hope we can do it just by modulating our diet if we can start to personalize it with technology over time. But today, I'm on statins. I'm out there. I mean, my cholesterol was 180, but based on the data, I'm on a statin because I need to delay things. Because if we delay, I believe the magic pills will come.
What exactly is a statin?
So statin was a class of drugs that were developed, you know, the Lipitor, Crestor, and there are generic ones out there. So again, the cost is $9 for a 90-day supply without health insurance from Walmart. But they was developed to block LDL, the bad cholesterol. It turns out they also exquisitely block inflammation. So much, though, that during that swine flu outbreak that happened a couple years ago, the one thing that protected you if you got swine flu from going on a ventilator was being on a statin because of its anti-inflammatory properties.
So, are there any health or mental problems related to using aluminum cooking pots and pans or aluminum foil? I'm sure you've never heard that one before.
You know, the true answer is we don't really know. So certainly, obviously, the more natural and the more you can be in moderation, the better. We always want to blame things. You know, what really taught me a lot was what happened with the cell phones with World Health Organization. World Health Organization made a public statement a year and a half ago saying cell phones may cause brain cancer. They did so because they looked at 26,000 individuals and they looked at their spouses, which were good control, right? They're normally genetically similar, same environment, they eat the same, they live the same. And they asked them, how much time do you use on your cell phone? So it turned out the people with the brain cancer spoke on the cell phone, according to the survey, 2.5 times more than their spouses. So they said it may be associated. When they went back and audited the data, they spoke exactly the same. It's just human nature is to blame something. So in their mind, they said the reason I got brain cancer is it must be because of them, because I must have talked into self for more. Same thing if you look at women with breast cancer. There's a beautiful study done on 2,000 women, and they asked them, what was your diet like before and after? And uniformly they said, my diet was horrible. I got breast cancer. I saw the light. My diet was great. When they went back and audited it, it was exactly the same. So human nature is to blame things. And so certainly we want to blame if we have a problem, whether it be the aluminum foiling, the pan, et cetera. It may be. There's no data now that it does. That doesn't mean it doesn't. And so, again, I believe in moderation. And so certainly if it's a problem or you think it's a problem, go the other direction. Don't use it.
Can you talk about the effect of mental illness, depression, stress, phobias on health?
So, you know, one of the big problems, obviously, in our country is mental illness. One of the things mental illness does is it makes you have an irregular schedule. You get depressed, you hang around the house, you don't walk, you don't eat your meals on a regular schedule, you don't socialize. In the Framingham Heart Study, our nation's biggest heart study, the most protective effect was owning a dog. And we thought as well, the dog relaxes you. It turns out it's not the case. Dogs put you on a regular schedule. You get up every morning, you walk the dog. You come home from work, you walk the dog. You don't stay out late because you got to walk that dog. You feed your dog your lunch, and you tend to have lunch at the same time. Mental illness, if you start to look at it, stress hormones, and it's a real problem, I'm not negating it, but stress hormones are markedly elevated. If you take someone with a mental illness and put them on a regular schedule, you can reduce by almost 25% the amount of medications required in a study done at Harvard. And so it's a problem. I think we have to look at creative solutions, and one of them is optimizing everything else in your life, including that schedule component.
That struck me as something very interesting in the book. What is it about the regularity and the schedule? What does that impact that makes a difference?
So your body, you know, strives for this regularity. And, you know, your body always wants to keep fine-tuning. Because remember, your body cares about today. It doesn't care about tomorrow. It's worried that you're going to get eaten by a lion and you're not going to be able to have children. So if you skip your lunch today, the stress hormones go right up the next 15 minutes later. And those stress hormones, they start to shut down functions in your body so you can preserve energy because it's afraid you're not going to get the calories you need and you're not going to perform optimally. And that's a stressor function. They took kids, and this is the wildest study, 600 kids in each arm. 600 kids, they said to the parents, go to bed whenever you want. Have your kids wake up 10 and a half hours later. Here's a clock. They said to the other, have your kids go to bed the same time and wake up in 10 and a half hours. A 31% improvement in cognition with the regularity and schedule. That's good to great right there. And so obviously if it happens in kids, it's probably more so in each of us. We need to push on the regularity part.
I've got so many and so little time here. For some diseases like diabetes, we know how to prevent problems, yet the prevalence of the disease is increasing. How do you account for this problem and what can be done?
Well, the diabetes increase is clearly related to the increase in our body mass index, in that, unfortunately, our country is becoming larger by the year. And so this was actually the first year over the last 16, I think it was, where actually BMI went down a little bit, which is a good sign. But we need to actually be lean body mass. And, you know, we look in California, and we get somewhat warped by the fact that we're not as obese here as other parts of the country. You go to Disneyland, and I went with the kids a couple weeks ago, I was shocked by the size of the people there. And so when you start to look in sub-Saharan Africa, which you say, listen, food is a problem, well, now diabetes is a problem because BMI, in, if you look at, you know, mild obesity, it's almost 40% of the population in Africa has mildly obese. And so we need to start to focus not just on food and calories, but on what is good food. You know, this is the first year since World War II there's not enough food to go around in the world. Recombinant food, which is DNA-based food, came out in the 70s and was all based on making more calories per acre. Well, we now have to go back and say, let's make better food. Let's look at what food makes sense. Let's start to say, you know, Michael Dell says, you're welcome to smoke a Dell computer to his 105,000 employees, but he says, I'm going to charge a different health insurance premium to people who smoke and don't smoke. And he's doing the same thing with obesity. We need to say, listen, we need to start to build in metrics to incentivize people to be lean body mass. We need to change programs at work where we say, listen, if you want to buy the burger at lunch, it's your right, but we're going to charge you twice the amount, and we're going to subsidize the salads and charge half the amount. We're going to start to say, listen, you know, we're going to use these like bracelets and say, if you walk 25% of the day or move, we're going to lower your cost in the cafeteria for lunch. We need to start to push. My kids, I couldn't get them to stop having chocolate milk. I gave them every argument about insulin and cortisol in the world. They just looked at me with a blank stare. They watched this crazy guy named Jamie Oliver on television.
Oh, right.
Who went and showed that if every kid at a school had chocolate milk, it would fill an entire school bus up with sugar. The next day, they stopped drinking chocolate milk. We need to find better ways of doing education. You know, I work with one of the guys here in Silicon Valley named Sal Khan, K-H-A-N, who has this Khan Academy. And we did some videos, which are the lowest tech videos in the world, about cancer as a complex system, vitamins for kids. And within weeks, tens of thousands of kids have seen them, and they get it. You know, John Kennedy said, we're going to put a man on the moon, and people thought he was crazy. 9 years later, Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon. The average age of missile command when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon was 27. Which means those kids were 18 when Kennedy made his proclamation. So no matter what you and I say about obesity, diabetes, it's not going to be our generation that solves it. It's the generation coming up now. We got to start to educate them about disease, about illness, about the body. Not about the biology that you and I learned, about the mitochondria and the nucleus, most of which was wrong. We need to educate them about disease in a new way of thinking.
In your opinion, what country should the U.S. be modeling its healthcare system? In other words, which country is doing it right?
So I believe it or not, and I know it always gets gasped from an audience, they get pissed off, but I think it's China now. You know, I think China and Singapore are really taking the lead and starting to mandate things. China is saying, you know, listen, you know, if you don't take an aspirin, we're going to start to penalize you. If you don't walk during the day, if companies don't ring a bell when they need to have lunch, there's going to be a fine on the companies. And when they say things, things get done. And I think that's the area we have to push on. We have to push on education. We have to push on prevention. And we're not doing it right now. So whatever means it takes, we have to start to do it. Because unless we do that, it ain't going to happen.
What role does consciousness play in gaining and maintaining health? How would you rank this compared to other changes one can make to their daily routine, such as eating right and getting plenty of exercise?
I'm not sure what you mean by consciousness here.
I think it was a question regarding sort of the mind-body connection.
You know, the mind-body connection is real. We can't quantify it, but it certainly is real. I see it every day. When a patient gives up hope, they die of the disease they have. And so that mind is tremendously important in controlling the body. So hope is one of the greatest enemies I have to fight disease. To me, hope is technology. Hope is many of the things we talk about in the book. And we have to keep pushing that hope going forward. And whether you're going to call it consciousness or hope, it's a key component, you know, to people. When people read Lance Armstrong's biography, that gives them hope. He's a beacon of hope for them. And we need to keep those pillars of hope and technology going forward going for us to have a future.
If having more muscle and GH shortens life, why does exercise increase lifespan?
Because exercise is just moving. And so if you look at it, you know, we published one of the chapters in the book is about football players. One of the shortest life expectancies of any profession in the world is a football player. They have inflammation, they're big muscle mass, they promote getting bigger, and yet they live till they're, you know, the 50s or 60s, which is shocking. So when I say exercise, I don't mean going to the gym and lifting free weights. I mean moving. I mean being lean body mass. That's where you're going to get a large benefit on health. And I mean blocking inflammation. You know, one of the great statements we make in the book, and I love it, is that, you know, I want you to focus on what shoes you wear during the day. If at the end of the day your feet hurt, that's inflammation and that's bad. I want you to wear shoes that have cushion. At the end of the day, your feet don't hurt because you've reduced inflammation.
I was quite interested in the whole section on the football players and thought that should go to every college football coach, let alone I hope the NFL is paying for some of the studies.
You know, CNN did a whole story on this and published a lot of the stuff, you know, on Super Bowl weekend. I can't tell you the hate email I got. And so, again, I'm not against football. I watch it like anybody else. But I am for trying to make football a better, safer sport.
Yeah.
And so when you make these statements, football has problems, you got to take it head on and say, what are the problems and how do we solve it? Do we need better helmets? Do we need better pads? Do we need to encourage them to be smaller? You know, we need different ways of approaching things.
A different type question. What is your take on the importance of sugar intake?
So, you know, it's one of these notions, I get it all the time, is, well, you know, I'm told that sugar is going to promote cancer. If I took your sugar level, it's going to be 100 today. If I took your sugar level after you eat a Snickers bar, it's still 100 if you don't have diabetes. It's controlled. So sugar intake doesn't cause disease. Certainly, if you want a way to reduce, you know, caloric intake and be lean body mass, reducing sugar is a good thing. But sugar itself doesn't cause disease. And I think that's what people don't get. And the sugar in an orange is the same as sugar in a teaspoon. Sugar is sugar. It's the same chemical molecular structure. So reducing sugar is a great way to lose weight and be lean body mass. At the same time, sugar itself is not a poison.
One of the things that also struck me that, and what I thought was refreshing about your book is you do use a lot of sources and cite lots of studies. But as the average consumer, just as you showed with vitamin D, you mm-hmm. can have a headline that says it does everything for everything. So what advice do you have for us as consumers in terms of, are there particular websites that you recommend people do their research with, ones that you would say stay away from, or what kind of discerning questions should one ask in doing their own research?
You know, I think it's a great question. And that's, you know, one of the premises of the book really is that you really need to look at the source documents. So something published in New England Journal of Medicine in a randomized study is much better than a journal you've never heard of. And I can't tell you, I get these emails all the time. Well, you said vitamins are bad, and there was this journal in the Journal of, you know, South American da-da-da-da that had seven patients that showed this. What do you say about this? I'm like, well, it doesn't make any sense. So I think randomized studies with a large number of patients, you got to look, you know, we talk about in the book how to interpret these studies. You got to look, are the patients like me? If it were done in China, it may not be like you if you're Caucasians. If it were done in you know, with the Swedish population, it may not be you if you're Southern European. And so look at who it was done in. Was it randomized? Was it big enough? Was it reproduced? What were the statistics? Which, again, puts a lot of onus on you as an individual. But unfortunately, this is your health. If you went to buy a car, you would look at 50 consumer sites. You look at every review before you make that decision. You don't just go and buy what looks pretty. And we have to do the same thing on health. And you have to really research before you put anything in your body. And so the book is a way to do it. There are other books out there. One of the greatest books on food, and I refer to in the book that I've ever read, is Michael Pollan's book called In Defense of Food. And it really is a beautiful argument on natural food, real food. And that's what I believe in.
Okay. One last somewhat tongue-in-cheek question. So we're out of time and wrapping up. So what do you think about the TV doctors or Dr. Oz, good or bad for our health?
You know, I like the fact that they're educating people and talking about issues. Many of the things they talk about I agree with or don't disagree with, but it doesn't matter. I think discourse is a good thing. So I want people to talk about health. I want there to be more shows like Dr. Oz where you push an issue. You know, I like him as a person. He's very smart. I don't agree with everything he says, but that's okay. Those discourses have to happen in front of the public. That's how we're going to get advances.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It's an honor to be here.
I hope you've all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. David Agus, director of USC's Westside Cancer Center and best-selling author of The End of Illness, Karen Story, co-founder of the Wellness Community, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.